Welcome to the Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards. The Reimagining Podcast is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which includes the Baltimore Wisdom Project and the Chicago Wisdom Project. Our shared mission is to reimagine education and reimagine the world by enhancing the lives of youth and adults with holistic education, intercultural understanding, and anti-oppressive liberationist thought leadership.
Is there a role for spiritual community and practice in the modern world? Are the old traditions even relevant in an age in which our institutions are collapsing, in which radical political action is called for? Isn't it a little self-indulgent to focus on the spiritual stuff? The answer is, well, maybe. It depends. Most of what passes for spiritual practice today is what I would call capitalist spirituality, spiritual practices that offer personal, individual salvation or happiness. But we are at a moment in human history that is teaching us this fundamental truth. We are deeply interconnected. The individual self is empty, as Buddhism teaches. A person exists only in community, as described in the Pan-African concept of Ubuntu. We are floating through the cosmos on this island planet together, entangled. We are in this together. Spirituality's fundamental task at this moment in history is to offer an antidote to loneliness, to the story that separates us. The question we all have is not so much about what happens to us after we die, but whether or not we are alone in the universe. If we are alone, no afterlife would be worth much. For me, even a blink of an eye with the possibility of true communion with others would be preferable to such an eternity. Lola Wright is an experienced creator, executive producer, author, coach, and speaker with an electric and dynamic presence and an extraordinary ability to be in the moment. Lola has worked with the world's leading global financial institutions, emerging and innovative nonprofit organizations, entrepreneurs, creatives, and cultural influencers. She has a unique capacity to connect with human beings seeking growth and change. Lola has spent over two decades developing her skills as a master communicator and keynote speaker. She has produced over 300 live events since 2014, including the most recent live experience she curated titled House of Bodhi with Lola Wright, highlighting some of the country's most prolific artists and leaders, marrying entertainment, current events, and community engagement. Lola is trained as a 15 commitments coach with the Conscious Leadership Group, life coach with the Life Mastery Institute, personal integration practitioner through Transformations, School of Integrative Psychology, licensed spiritual practitioner with the Centers for Spiritual Living, ordained minister through Emerson Theological Institute, and former introduction leader with Landmark Worldwide. Lola is a devoted partner to her husband, with whom she has facilitated couples coaching, retreats, and workshops. She and her husband are master practitioners of the mundane and are raising four wildly creative children ranging from age 22 to 8. Lola, welcome to Reimagining.
Thank you. I'm very grateful to be with you.
And we are grateful to have you. Lola, you know, I'd like to kind of start conversation, and we're focusing a lot on community today, and particularly spiritual community, and we'll unpack a little bit about kind of what that means. But I, you know, my connection to you largely comes from the spiritual community that you led for many years in Chicago. So maybe to start, can we talk a little bit about Bodhi and how you got involved with Bodhi and how it evolved and what Bodhi meant to you and how you defined it as a spiritual community. So where'd you start with Bodhi? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I started attending Bodhi as a young single mom in, I think, 2005. I was, you know, had been raised Catholic, didn't feel like a Christian paradigm was a right fit for me, was wanting community, was wanting intentional community, conscious community, some kind of routine that I could cultivate with my kids. And a friend recommended checking out Bodhi. I arrived there on a Sunday morning and was like, wow, this is exactly what I have wanted. Ridiculous music, a powerful message, and a philosophy that felt very much in alignment with the way I oriented myself. I engaged there as a community member for a number of years, and then in 2012, left a corporate career in banking and became the director of youth and family at Bode. The founder then left pretty shortly thereafter and relatively abruptly. And at that point, I had sort of cycled through a series of roles pretty quickly. I became the senior director of business operations and then the executive director. And through sort of a period of my own reflection and consideration and conversation with the board, became very clear that I felt called to lead this community into this next iteration. And so in 2014, I became the spiritual director and had the great gift and privilege to lead that community until I resigned in February of 2020.
So let's back up a little bit, because I think some of this really speaks to kind of like bigger questions about where we are, you know, as a species, even in this moment in human history. So you grew up in a Christian church, and Bode has a sort of a New Thought heritage, right? But it goes definitely in a less Christian and more interfaith direction than some New Thought communities. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah, well, to be specific, I was raised Catholic, and my grandparents were devout social justice Catholics that were very involved in a variety of different movements, were largely involved in the HIV and AIDS crisis in the 80s as my uncle was dying of AIDS. And between sort of witnessing the way that the church responded through that crisis and then watching my mom come out in 1992, I just became aware that I needed something far more expansive than a traditional religious paradigm. Bode was affiliated since its inception with an organization called the Centers for Spiritual Living, which is a philosophy, not a religious tradition, and was sort of birthed out of transcendentalism and really sort of explores the intersection of science, religion, and philosophy. And I mean, I could go down a lot of rabbit holes there, but the word Bode comes out of the Buddhist tradition, said that the Buddha awakened under the Bode tree. And what we have stood for from the beginning is that awakening is really for the many, not the few. It's not this idea of like a few saints, sages, mystics, and masters that we're here to sort of outsource our salvation to, but that in fact, like these great master teachers really walked on the planet, I think, as a demonstration and an invitation for the potentiality of humanity. And so if we could know our divinity, our wholeness, our sacred nature, we would sort of actualize this greater sense of self.
Sure. Yeah. So it's a little bit of, we have like in many of the more mainstream traditions, we have this sort of theistic and very dualistic worldview, right? Where it's like divinity is out there beyond us or something separate, right? And, you know, it's many of the traditions, though, that have a more, and it's true in everything from, you know, it's true in Vedanta, it's true in Sufism, it's true in many of these different traditions that you have this more panentheistic view, which is that there is a transcendent divinity, but there's also a divinity in us and in everything else. And I think that's, is that pretty consistent, I think, with your tradition and that?
Yeah, that feels very true. And, you know, I am always reluctant to like identify with the New Thought movement, because I'm pretty critical of the New Thought movement for a whole variety of reasons. But I do believe that it's in its essence, it is this really, really beautiful articulation and interpretation of the great world traditions. And yeah,
Okay. Yeah. So you said it. So we're going to go down there. So tell me, so what are some of your criticisms? Like where do you part ways with it? Or where did you kind of struggle with kind of fitting in there? What was difficult for you in the New Thought movement?
Well, unfortunately, I think that the New Thought movement, which just so for those who don't know, the New Thought movement is comprised of Christian Science, Divine Science, Religious Science, Unity. I would say those are the big ones. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I said, that movement was really birthed out of transcendentalism. And at the time of its creation or its formation, it was a pretty radical idea that the presence of the infinite or God or divinity wasn't, as you said, separate from oneself. In fact, it could be found in nature. It could be found in the indwelling presence, et cetera, et cetera. And I would say that one of my critiques is that it can be very intellectual. It can be very academic. It's a cousin of the Unitarian Universalist tradition, which also can be very academic, very cerebral.
Sure,
and I think that where people, and I think, by the way, that's a challenge in, you know, generally speaking, in Western culture. There's a dislocation from our emotional body and our physical body. And so that would be one critique. The other critique is that it sort of became like co-opted, if you will, by white culture, and I would say like affluent white culture. And so the depth of the teachings got sort of dumbed down, if you will, and like sort of simplified into this kind of elitist philosophy that was like came sort of popularized by the law of attraction. I feel like it has at times lost its breadth. And I don't think that the movement itself has done a great job of articulating how we account for social discord, social injustices. You know, it can be right. Almost too esoteric and not very practical. And I actually don't believe that that's what its original formation intended to have happen. But
yeah,
there's beings and...
Yeah. Those are some really interesting threads that I want to unpack a little bit. What's interesting to me is how you mentioned it sort of as dumbing down and the simplification of the teachings, and which you sort of connected to kind of like this. What I'm hearing a little bit is sort of like feels like there's a connection to kind of this, you just said white culture, but almost like this sort of bourgeois, capitalist, consumer mm-hmm. culture in a way.
Yes. Right?
Like, how can we package this so that it becomes something that's easily kind of consumable or purchasable by people in like easy, because one of the things we have a lot of and I think the culture that you're trying to critique here, and this relates to the last thing you said in terms of like focusing on the kind of esoteric personal journey as opposed to like broader issues that are affecting the world. One of the things that I think happens in this kind of capitalist consumer culture is that we try to package things in such a way where they're consumable. And when mm-hmm. we do that, one of the ways we do that is we focus on sometimes telling people maybe what they want to hear and not focusing on the challenges that there might be on the way.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that what you just articulated is the biggest challenge to my personal brand, if you will. Like, you know, like I have always been one from the time that I was a little girl that would say the thing that people didn't want to necessarily say or hear. And I would also say that like, this is my critique of the overarching wellness movement or mm-hmm. spiritual, but not religious movement is like, we have extracted these sound bites from really deep traditions and we have packaged them in a way that suggests that people can experience a kind of transformation without, I think, doing the internal work that actually is required for the kind of transformation that's being sold.
Yeah.
And like that really, it frustrates me. It irritates me because, you know, I watch, especially in like social media and just in mainstream advertising, sort of taking like little bits of these teachings, and in some cases, not even articulating them accurately or appropriately, but wow, making a lot of money in the process.
One of the things that I like to say is, if you want to like make a lot of money from the pulpit, tell people what they want to hear. Mm-hmm. And I think there's an interesting kind of corollary with our current moment. You know, we're talking right now in the midst of a kind of global epidemic and we're in the middle of this sort of really complicated, well, in some ways it's not complicated, but this real tension between the challenge of dealing with pandemic, a global pandemic, and the reality of that, which is it's going to be a hard thing to deal with. And then the other hand, there's a tendency among some to tell people, well, everything's fine, go shopping, right? And it's not that everything's not going to be okay. I think it will be, but it also doesn't mean that everything's easy and we can just kind of ignore the reality of suffering.
Yeah, it's such a, like, I think that this is like threading the needle right now, because it's like, I see both poles, like a polarity, right, occurring. It's like there's the tendency to just be completely taken out by despair. Sure. And then there's the tendency to completely bypass the reality. And as I have matured, thank God, I have come to realize that like there's a lot more in the middle between those poles. So I do think that like we all would be served by minding our tendency to live in these like sweeping extremes of how we say it is. I went to our local butcher yesterday and I asked them like, hey, you know, it's a small lot of like local farmers come through, et cetera, et cetera. And right. I asked them like how business is doing. And they said, it's been like Christmas for 2 weeks. And I said, well, I really appreciate hearing that because we can allow our minds to be completely taken out by doom and gloom. And again, it's like, what's the right balance of acknowledging there is an impact? Like, we must be sober about that. There is an impact. And creativity is birthed at times of crisis. So how do we want to orient ourselves so that we don't experience being like victimized by this thing? It's like, but how can all of it be true?
Yeah. I think that's exactly it. I've, you know, really been sort of reflecting on the ways in which being kind of turning within and being in these quiet spaces that we're so self, like we're always kind of out there doing stuff. You feel compelled to do so much stuff all the time. And that in itself is something of, I think, a disease, right? That we have to grow,
totally,
have to make more money and have to do stuff all the time. And there's this real kind of Anglo-Saxon Protestant guilt we feel about not doing anything.
So I say all the time, being still is a radical act. I mean, it is a radical act.
And it is because it runs counter to the entire worldview of our civilization, which says we have to do more, we have to make more money, we have to consume more and more and more. And the lesson, I think one of the lessons, there are a few different lessons, but one of the lessons of the coronavirus shutdown, if you will, is that we actually can stop moving around. We actually have to stop moving around for good reason now, but we also can stop moving by choice. Mm-hmm. And it's mm-hmm. good. We're going to be okay if we don't go to work today. You know what I mean? Or we don't like do that thing that we had to do today. Right.
Yes. I am very, very curious to see how this all alters the way we organize ourselves moving forward. And at every opportunity I have, I'm inviting the people I'm in relationship with to be consciously creating how this will alter their life moving forward in a way that serves each of us. I mean, it's a huge opportunity. Like, you know, I do a fair amount of work with businesses and organizations and working with innovative leaders to bring more conscious practices into the environment beyond just like mindfulness, which is important and wonderful, but something more robust than that. And, you know, the conversations I've been having with leaders just in the last week is like, this is an opportunity to recalibrate. And as an organizational leader that may say you're interested in a conscious business practice, like please use this time to imagine what that could look like.
Yeah, that is certainly one of the, and not to kind of minimize the genuine threat and suffering that's happening, but I do think there's for sure an opportunity here. So let's unpack that a little bit. Let's do some reimagining then. Talk to me about like some of the things that you'd like to, I mean, you mentioned mindfulness, which is kind of, to me, is extraordinarily important. I think occasionally it's sort of, as we talked earlier, you know, it's one of those sort of buzzwords that probably is sort of appropriated and watered down sometimes. But what are those, you know, so in addition to that, what are some kind of practices or what directions would you like to see things push? Not even just in the workplace, but in civilization in general.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's pretty like core to my own existence and then in any work I do with others is really like, am I able to identify where I am in this now moment? And can I have self-awareness such that I'm able to notice if I am moving from like a closed and defensive reptilian brain state Or am I moving from a place of openness and curiosity, you know, the higher states of consciousness? And either one is okay. You know, like I have absolutely no delusions that we're going to, in the immediate term, eliminate our reptilian tendencies. All I'm asking is just, can you notice them? So, you know, like one of the things that I'm asking the leaders that I'm working with presently is like, okay, now your entire team is working remotely. Notice the tendency in creating busy work as a means by which to control the labor force so that you don't have to feel your fear. You know what I mean? So it's like,
yeah, absolutely.
Like, oh, yeah. I just want to, you know, sort of drive my labor force, no matter what, where they are in the hierarchy or the org chart. I'm just going to create a culture of driving productivity, driving results, not because that's necessarily the most effective strategy or way of being, but because I have an incapacity to be with my fear, and I have no capacity to trust the rhythms of other human beings, you know? So like, that's just like a little, and I'm watching myself, right? Like with my own kids.
It's, I was gonna say, you got it. Do you have a homeschool? I'm looking right at my desk in front of me about my homeschool schedule. I'm like, oh my God, yeah. You know, everybody's going to meditate at noon, whether they like it or not. Right. So,
yeah. And so what's the balance between structure and flow, structure and flow, structure and flow. And so that's just a little example of what I think we each are being called into.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment. Reimagining is a place for people who believe that the stories of the modern world no longer sustain us, bringing us to the brink of catastrophe, ecologically, economically, spiritually. Our troubles cannot be solved merely through technology or even politics. Rather, we need to reimagine what it means to be human. We seek new stories, new poetics, new ideas, and we put our ideas and stories into action. This work requires the wisdom of those at the margins and by those with the courage to imagine a new world. Welcome back to the Reimagining Podcast. We're talking with Lola Wright today. It feels to me like what you're doing is challenging something that's pretty deep and is not like, that doesn't feel like an easy thing to get people to do. Like, so I'd imagine it most, and I'm sure there's a variety of organizations or businesses that you, or individuals that you're dealing with, but for the culture in general, for our civilization in general, I think that there's certainly, there's sometimes a desire to kind of like appropriate a thing like mindfulness because it can be shown to increase productivity, right? Like that kind of thinking, you know what I mean? And if we can get people to meditate, they'll be, you know, less stressed out, they'll be able to work longer, right? That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I think, if I'm hearing you correctly, that's not exactly what you're suggesting is the way to go. I think what you're suggesting is that actually, well, for one, you're addressing not just the kind of workers, but you're addressing management, for lack of a better word. And you're saying like, let's actually let go of this need for constant productivity, constant control. You know what I mean? Like, I think this question of control is a big one. And I think that's why I see coronavirus as an example of a, well, I think coronavirus is a, certainly a public health crisis, an economic crisis, but it perhaps is as much going to be a psychological crisis.
Yes.
Because people are confronting that lack of control in what's happening.
Yes. And That's right.
Really hard. You know, I like to say in our need for control, we've paved over most of the world. And now we're looking up and realizing that it was all an illusion anyway.
That's exactly right.
For one, because we can't control, you know what I mean? And on top of it, we've sort of paved over something in ourselves, which is the kind of wild, creative, chaotic part of ourselves, which is so important, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was working with my husband owns a landscape design build firm, and I was helping him craft an email to his clients and partners and et cetera today. The opening sentence is something like, you know, look, our business has understood the lack of control that we have since its inception. Mm. Like if you work with nature, in any capacity, you know very well how little control you have. And so, you know, it is a great opportunity to look at the ways, like what I've been doing in my own practice at home right now is really allowing myself to feel the micro belief structure that I can pretty well anesthetize when I'm in the busyness of my life. And so what I sort of hit the ground running with this quarantine. I was like, I was cooking. I was like e-learning. Yes, I'm with it. I got this. And then
you're
like
winning.
You were winning the quarantine. totally winning. And 5 days in, I just started to crumble. And I have a practice. I know my interior very well. And so I asked my husband to come sit with me. And what I got clear on was like, I have lived through some very, very challenging times that, you know, danced with poverty and domestic violence and blah, 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 blah. And what I got was that at a micro level of my being, I am still operating out of never wanting to go back there ever again and feeling attached to the success, accomplishment, security, control, comfort that I've established. And look, I don't want to go back there. And yet, if I'm unconscious to the fact that that fear still has a pretty good stronghold in me, I'm not free. And right. I committed to being free. So what I was able to do in that moment was like, I want to amp that fear up so I can bring it into greater consciousness and do whatever interior work I need to do to transform that. And I believe that that's precisely the gift of this now moment, is like any part of yourself that you've been unwilling to deal with, you have the opportunity to consciously bring that to the surface and do the self-inquiry to transform, transmute, understand, et cetera.
Yeah. And perhaps that the opening we have now to look at ourselves more closely and more clearly, I think is also a scary thing. Right.
Totally.
So in addition to the lack of control, in addition to the actual just sort of like physical terror of a disease, there's also this like, you know, I'm sitting at home now. I can't just go out and do this and that and keep myself occupied and focus on other people's stuff. And sometimes you focus on other things that are great. Like you might be out, you know, saving the world, but not taking that time to look at yourself. And that can be really terrifying to be kind of put in that position.
Oh yeah. I mean, we're in a kind of existential crisis. And what's interesting is that with the deconstruction of religious traditions and spiritual communities, I don't know that we've created what the next thing is to help people have context for those kinds of existential questions.
I think you're completely spot on there. I think, you know, in some ways we've got no idea what the form and the context for doing that work is, because we're still, you know, and I think this is the challenge that a lot of kind of spiritual communities and a lot of spiritual practices, and we're talking, you know, kind of about the co-optation of traditions. And in some ways, it's understandable how these traditions aren't fully realized. It's because the overarching worldview hasn't changed. We're doing practices, you know, one example I like to give, and I think it's relevant to your work because I think there's a lot of crossover and similarities, is particularly as you're talking about mindfulness. You know, I talk a lot about kind of Buddhist practice and how Buddhist practice is completely useful for someone to do without kind of really engaging with the underlying Buddhist worldview and philosophy, for sure. You know, you can get many, many benefits from various traditions of Buddhist practice. But what's often not recognized, and it's very difficult for particularly kind of Western people to understand, is that the ultimate, the essential realization of the Buddha was not about personal enlightenment. It was actually the notion that this kind of, that enlightenment itself was a letting go of the attachment to this individual self.
That's right. Right? That's the paradox.
Like that whole thing right there. Yeah, that whole thing right there. So we're not working to sort of like escape this world. And guess what? Like we're learning now with a virus that seems to have no bias toward anyone. and connects us in a terrifying way, doesn't it? It's like mm-hmm. we are all part of this. There's no getting out of it. There's nowhere to go, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, that paradox, as you put it, and that it's really hard to go there, though. It's really hard to get to a place of thinking about how am I going to kind of individually save myself, as opposed to there is no individual to save. I mean, there's a self, but it's not mm-hmm. separate from yourself, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that to me is the beauty of this moment, is like, wow, if we ever wondered the depth of our interconnectedness, let this be a demonstration of that. And also just like the made up boundaries and walls and yeah. borders. I mean, yeah. it's like, it's so,
right.
it's one extraordinary metaphor, if you will.
Yeah. In some ways, it's the very same lesson that we've been learning kind of slowly from climate change. And,
yes.
you know, we're on this planet together, and it's, there's nowhere else. I know that like Jeff Bezos wants to fly off to Mars and stuff, but like letting that go for a second, the reality is we're for the most part just here together.
And that's exactly right.
There's not like, you can't just move to a good neighborhood to get away from climate change, right?
Nope. It will find you.
Yeah. It already is, right? So let me ask you this too. I think that similarly, it feels to me like there's one of the kind of many dualisms that we have in our civilization has to do with this, is with the internal and external. And mm-hmm. I think that in a lot of ways, I think your work speaks to that. In other words, you know, we're dealing with kind of like the external factors, the external suffering of something like climate change or coronavirus. And at the same time, we're also suffering from this kind of internal challenge of our fundamental, you know, because I think when we do draw these lines between ourselves and others, we also become lonely. We become less connected and it's harder to find joy.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, a couple thoughts I'm having. I mean, one of my great influencers is a philosopher by the name of Ernest Holmes. And he wrote a lot about like, turn entirely away from the condition and go within. But he wasn't saying deny that the condition is occurring. Mm-hmm. He didn't say pretend like it's not happening. Really, the invitation was begin to get wildly curious as to how your cosmology of beliefs and thoughts are related to the condition. So I think yes, that's, right. you know, like one of my favorite memes that's going around right now is like this sort of figure drawing of someone in the lotus position, and it's like, can't go outside, go inside. That being right. said, I think that like the critique that I have of many of the sort of popularized movements of the day that are oriented around self-awareness is that there is not an accounting for like the collective. And so, you know, I oftentimes will cite Josiah Royce, who preceded Dr. King in the formation of the Beloved Community, and the premise of his work was essentially like, the human condition will become highly neurotic if it is only oriented around individuality. And so we can celebrate one's personality, we can celebrate one's individuality, but when we become so self-focused, we will literally provoke neuroses, which I actually believe is what you find quite frequently in many of these sort of like popularized spiritual movements. Because if there is not a component that has us understand the ways that we are intrinsically connected one to another and responsible for one another, you will become neurotic. It yeah. will expose yeah. your neuroses and activate them and exaggerate them.
Yeah. I think we have an epidemic of what I'd call, you know, an epidemic of loneliness. And mm-hmm. what I mean by that, I don't mean just like people who are kind of sad because they don't have enough friends around. I mean, that's part of it for sure. But I think what we have is a cosmology that places us fundamentally alone in the universe. And this works well for kind of a capitalist civilization. It's like, you know, if we're the lonelier we feel, the more we are likely to buy more stuff, for one. And I think, you know, we're also feeling this need to connect, this need mm-hmm. to have more. And that's not what we really need. It's also kind of, I think, the root of many addictions as well. Like this
yes.
need to feel that connection and joy. It's all, I think, rooted on a fundamental delusion, which is that separation of inner and outer. Yes. And I agree with you. I think it's a critique I've had of a lot of these traditions that speak of kind of like, I often hear one of the truisms you hear, I'm sure you hear it all the time too, I can't fix the world until I fix myself, or that something such as that, right? You hear that all the time.
Right.
I get where that's coming from. And I think it's coming largely from a place of like a need for self-care in addition to doing kind of work in the world. And we don't want to have an imbalance of those two. But I'm in favor of knocking that boundary down altogether and doing the work together. I think that they're not fundamentally different. I mean, for sure, if we're going to deal with climate change, for example, where we have to change our way of thinking and our way of positioning ourselves in the world, if we're going to deal with it, in addition to actual changes outside of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that's coming to my mind as I hear you speak of that is what ultimately had me depart from, I mean, there are a number of things that had my departure from Bodhi occur, but one of the things that I finally just was like, hey, you know, what I was aware of was this commitment to individualism and this commitment to consumerism and this commitment to expecting this community to deliver up the individual's needs without any kind of cooperative or very minimal cooperative and collaborative investment. And it's to be determined whether Bodhi will be able to sort of reinvent itself now that I have left. And I only say that just because, you know, a lot of nonprofits really require a strong set of shoulders. And I think it's partially because, if not exclusively, because of this transactional relationship we have with the things that we say matter to us. And so what became clear as I started to untangle myself from this nonprofit organization that served thousands of people was that our community became aware, and some more quickly than others, that they had been in a relationship with this thing that they love, and they weren't really doing their part. And all of a sudden, a moment of sobriety kicked in. And if you have a few people over-functioning, that is not a sustainable model. And that's where I had to really become honest with myself. Like, where am I reliably heroing this organization, this community? Where am I reliably taking more than 100% responsibility? And as someone who is committed to reorienting my focus around self and around the family unit that I'm immediately responsible for, it really does sort of beg the question, like, I became aware that I had to disrupt the codependence that was existing between this community and me. And I just think that's a really interesting inquiry right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting inquiry sort of both on an individual level for you and how to kind of navigate that. It's funny because, you know, when we talk about something like spiritual community, it feels like it ought to be engaged in a way. That's why language is so important around these things. And sometimes we don't have the right language. Like, it feels like it ought to be kind of, there ought to be a way to talk about it and to, you know, just sort of process it in a way that's not, as you put it, not transactional and not like just a job, right? I'm sure it was more than a job for you, but we often think of these in these transactional terms and in these kind of, you know, we often don't have the language for how to navigate these things in today's context. So this is, you know, we could go on a long time about this, but like, what do you see as kind of, and maybe this is too hard of a question, but how would you like to see a spiritual community develop in today's context? Like, what are some of the attributes of a spiritual community that you'd like to see come be brought forth?
Well, if I were to be completely honest, I am not optimistic about spiritual community. And it may just be that I'm in a period of cynicism around it, but I do feel like what is requiring, I guess, and maybe this is the answer, like, I guess the thing that I couldn't figure out as someone who led a community was how could I, like, I have a big presence, I have a big personality, I am very charismatic, and how can that exist without having other humans disempower themselves and then like outsource their power, authority, agency, freedom, creativity to me? you know? Yeah. And I think that like, that's one of the things that's so frustrating about spiritual communities is like, I think there's great value in leadership and sort of, you know, having people identify what their gifts and strengths and contributions are and organizing those in a particular way. But if that somehow gets collapsed with outsourcing your authority and your good to a figurehead, then like this thing's not going to work. So I think, I guess I would say that like, in order for any community organization, I think, to thrive, is there must be a sense of self that, you know, like a sense of wholeness that people have. Because if people are coming from like a woundedness or a brokenness and then seeking wholeness outside of themselves and projecting them that onto a single leader, like that is faulty from the start. And I think I was sort of naive about that. So I don't know. I feel a little like disinterested in spiritual community because in my experience, it tends to attract people who are healing and not willing to disrupt and maybe can't disrupt the practice of projection.
Well, I was going to say, it's great. So, and also perhaps part of the reason that you stepped away is because the other side of that, the other thing that is that spiritual community often can attract, and I've seen this happen many times, is it attracts people who are all similarly. So you were sort of describing on the one end, people who are sort of addicted to being, you know, saved in a way, right? Like, so there's this sort of like constant need to be helped and to get that sustenance and energy from someone else. On the other side of it, oftentimes, and this evidently isn't you because this is why you walked away, but often you get people who really need to be the savior. And that opens the door for kind of all kinds of dysfunction and abuse in those contexts.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on some level, maybe I did require that at some point. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I mean, who knows? But yeah. I ended up really resenting it because I'm like, gosh, as someone who really loves to celebrate the bigness of me, like I do not want that to inhibit or prohibit the genius and the brilliance of others. And so I don't know. I'm just personally being like extremely intentional around who and how and with what I collaborate on and going forward, because I just don't want that. You know, there's a great podcast called This Jungian Life, and it's three psychoanalysts that did an episode on projection. I highly recommend it. It's fascinating. And I'm just like very clear that if projection's the game you want to play, I will not be your partner. Like I can say, unfortunately, it's like an epidemic in spiritual communities.
Yeah, for sure. I think one challenge that a spiritual community has, and I think it's the same challenge that in some way all of our institutions have, but perhaps in something that's like, I'll use the word church here because it's, and I'm using it intentionally because it's kind of it feels like an older term, but the reality is we all sort of in some subtle way or less subtle way revert to kind of these institutional patterns that we're familiar with.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So,
yes.
And like, I'm thinking about the question of your content that you might speak versus like the subtle messages that someone might get. So someone walks into a space and they see you as a leader, they project onto you these ideas that are disempowering in some ways. And you might be saying something that's completely contradictory to that, but the kind of whole notion of church, right? We'll just use the word church. It conjures up all of these kinds of patterns that we have.
Totally.
And narratives. Totally. And the narratives we have, right? There's a deep narrative that we have as soon as we walk into a space like a church. And it's by definition, these narratives are unspoken. And it's teaching us things that we're not aware of and reinforcing things we're not aware of. So it becomes really a challenge to undermine that. I wonder if, you know, the answer to spiritual community is to have it look nothing like what we think of as a spiritual community. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, that's what I ultimately moved towards. I mean, we stopped doing Sundays in July, first and foremost, because we lost our space. But it also was just like, this is not it. Like, first of all, there's zero statistical data to support that this is the future. And yeah, it's not working for a whole variety of reasons. And so I personally was like, okay, if I were just to get like radically curious about what lights me up, I want to create a variety show. I want to create like a conscious variety show that, you know, highlights brilliant cultural leaders and artists in and around Chicago and is sort of like Phil Donahue meets Oprah Winfrey meets In Living Color. And it's performative. It's clear. You're coming to a show. So make no mistake about it. And we ended up launching this thing in October called House of Bodhi with Lola Wright. And it was so much fun. It was like, and people knew exactly what they were coming to. They were not coming to like have me be some kind of ministerial presence. They were coming to be consciously entertained and provoked.
Yeah. Provocation is good. I think that's a good, that's a good place to be. So in addition to that, what's next for you? You know, what do you see? What do you see the big thing coming next for you is?
You know, I think it will be more of the same. Like, I do love a microphone. I mean, I just have to be really honest about that. I love speaking. I love, like, something happens, something takes over my being, and I lose all sense of time and space. And so I'm really committed to supporting human beings. Like, I believe that, like, I have this unique gift, and we all have them. And, like, communication is a gift that I have. And so I want to support human beings in interrupting, disrupting fear-based patterns of scarcity, lack, limitation, and rising into higher states of consciousness, awareness, where abundance can be experienced, felt, freedom, wholeness, aliveness, creativity. And so I imagine that will look like live events. I imagine that will look like a book. I imagine that will look like coaching and classes and all that. I mean, I don't know that it will change that much. I just got clear that I wanted to be free of the limitation of a nonprofit organization, which we could do a whole episode on in and of itself.
Indeed, we could.
So I wanted to be free of that hindrance. And I wanted to feel like, look, if I say something and you don't like it, I'm the only person impacted by what I just said. I will take full responsibility for it. And I'm not trying to satisfy a constituency, if you will. So yeah. I think it's more the same with greater freedom, greater reach, greater impact. And I am just at a point in my life where I am committed to orienting my life around joy and leveraging my gifts and talents as best I can. I don't think there's anything cute or sexy in having kids with student loan debt and my kids want to go to college. So I'm not going to transform a capitalist society. I love Adrienne Marie Brown talks about what might post-capitalism look like. You know, what if it wasn't that we needed to necessarily go back to socialism, but what could a post-capitalist society look like? And so, yeah, so I'm just like, I'm really curious. I'm taking time to be still. I feel like I went on sabbatical and then the entire world joined me. and so it's sort of an interesting time.
Yeah, it is an interesting time. It's a time of uncertainty. As you know, I like to say it's an apocalyptic time. And that means, which means that it doesn't just mean that old things are ending. It also means that new things are being born. It means that something new is being unveiled. And that strikes me as what your work is about unveiling what that new thing is. And the scary part of it isn't just that our old institutions are dying. That in itself would probably make a lot of people happy. It's that we don't know. I agree. Yes. We're not going to go back to a kind of, certainly few people would ask to go back to a Stalinist society or something like that. I think it's that we don't know what the new economy will look like. Mm-hmm. We don't know what's going to happen. You know, we don't know what it's going to look like when we all walk out of our homes in a few weeks or a few months or whenever the thing passes away. But we know that the world will be different and will be different.
Yeah. And we have a limited capacity to be with the unknown. And that's what this is exposing. And that's good awareness.
Lola, thanks so much for joining us. And there's more information on our website about you and your work. And I thank you for being here. And I thank you for all your work and for your imagination and your passion.
Oh, I'm very grateful for you. Thank you, Theodore.
The Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated. Original music by Cosmos Ray. Sound engineering by Jim Qualick. Thank you for listening and for reimagining with us.